One. Two.
With a violent trembling underfoot and a harsh grating sound, the slab lunged closer. Hatch felt his own hand and wrist suddenly squeezed between the tightening rocks. Wapner gave a violent shudder, then a wet gasp. As Hatch watched in horror, the beam of his light angling into the narrow space with pitiless clarity, he saw the programmer's eyes, bulging from his head, turn first pink, then red, then black. There was a splitting sound, and the helmet burst along its seams. Sweat on the crushed cheeks and nose grew tinged with pink as the slab inched still closer. A jet of blood came rushing from one ear, and more blood burst from the tips of Wapner's fingertips. His jaw buckled, sagging sideways, the tongue protruding into the oxygen mask.
"The rock's still slipping!" Hatch screamed. "Get me something, anything to—"
But even as he spoke, he felt the programmer's head come apart under his hand. The oxygen mask began to burble as its airway grew clogged by a rush of fluids. There was a strange vibration between his fingers, and to his horror, he realized it was Wapner's tongue, twitching spastically as the nerves that fired the muscles burned out.
"No,"
Hatch cried in despair.
"Please, God, no."
Black spots appeared before his eyes as he staggered against the rock, unable to catch his breath in the thick air, fighting to pull his own hand free from the increasing pressure.
"Dr. Hatch, step away," Needleman warned.
"Melin!"
screamed Bonterre.
"Hey, Mal,"
Hatch heard his brother Johnny whisper out of the rushing darkness.
"Hey, Mal, over here."
Then the darkness closed upon him, and he knew no more.
Chapter 30.
By midnight, the ocean had taken on the kind of oily, slow-motion swell that often came after a summer blow. Hatch stood up from his desk and went to the Quonset hut window, moving carefully through the darkened office. He stared past the unlit huts of base camp, looking for lights that would indicate the coroner was finally on his way. Lines of spindrift lay in ghostly threads across the dark water. The rough weather seemed to have temporarily blown the fog from the island, and the mainland was visible on the horizon, an uncertain strand of phosphorescence under the star-strewn sky. He sighed and turned from the window, unconsciously massaging a bandaged hand. He'd sat alone in his office as the evening turned to night, unwilling to move, unwilling even to turn on the lights. Somehow, the darkness made it easier to avoid the irregular shape that lay on the gurney under a white sheet. It made it easier for him to push back all the thoughts and quiet whispers that kept intruding onto the edges of his consciousness. There came a soft knock and the turn of a door handle. Moonlight framed the spare outline of Captain Needleman standing in the doorway. He slipped into the hut and disappeared into the dark shape of a chair. There was a scratching noise, and the room briefly flared yellow as a pipe was lit. The faint sounds of drawing smoke reached Hatch's ears a moment before the scent of Turkish Latakia. "No sign of the coroner, then?" Needleman asked. Hatch's silence was answer enough. They had wanted to bring Wapner to the mainland, but the coroner, a fussy, suspicious man who had come down all the way from Machiasport, insisted on moving the body as little as possible. The captain smoked in silence for several minutes, the only evidence of his presence the intermittent glow from the pipe bowl. Then he laid the pipe aside and cleared his throat. "Malin?" he asked softly.
"Yes,"
Hatch replied, his own voice sounding husky and foreign in his ears.
"This has been a devastating tragedy. For all of us. I was very fond of Carrie."
"Yes,"
said Hatch again. "I remember," the captain went on, "leading a team working deep water salvage off Sable Island, the graveyard of the Atlantic. We had six divers in a barometric pressure chamber,
decompressing after a 100-meter dive to a Nazi sub loaded with gold. Something went wrong. The seal of the chamber failed. Hatch heard him shifting in his chair. You can imagine what happened. Massive embolisms. Blows apart your brain, then stops your heart. Hatch said nothing. One of those young divers was my son. Hatch looked at the dark figure.
I'm very sorry, he said. I had no idea.
He stopped.
I had no idea you were a father. Or a husband.
In fact, he really knew next to nothing about Needleman's personal life. Jeff was our only child. The death was very hard on both of us. And my wife, Adelaide, well, she couldn't quite forgive me.
Hatch fell silent again, remembering the stark outline of his own mother's face that November afternoon they learned of his father's death. She had picked up a china candlestick from the mantelpiece, polished it absently with her apron, replaced it, then picked it up and polished it again, over and over, her face as gray as the empty sky. He wondered what Carrie Wapner's mother was doing at that moment.
God, I'm tired. Needleman shifted again in his chair, more briskly this time, as if to force himself awake. These things happen in this business, he said. They're unavoidable.
Unavoidable, Hatch repeated.
I'm not trying to excuse it. Carrie was aware of the risks, and he made that choice. Just as we all did.
Despite himself, Hatch found his eyes straying involuntarily to the misshapen form under the sheet. Dark stains had seeped through the material, ragged black holes in the moonlight. He wondered if Wapner really had made the choice.
The point is, the captain lowered his voice, we must not let this defeat us.
With an effort, Hatch pulled his eyes away. He sighed deeply. I suppose I feel the same way. We've come this far. Carrie's death would be even more pointless if we abandoned the project completely. We'll take the time we need to review our safety procedures. Then we can...
Needleman sat forward in his chair. The time we need. You misunderstand me, Malin. We must move forward tomorrow.
Hatch frowned. How can we, in the wake of all this? For one thing, morale is rock bottom. Just this afternoon I heard a couple of workers outside my window saying the whole venture's cursed, that nobody will ever recover the treasure.
But that's exactly why we must press on, the captain continued, his voice now urgent. Stop the malingering. Make them lose themselves in their work. It's not surprising people are rattled. What would you expect after such a tragedy? Talk of curses and supernatural falderal is a seductive, undermining force. And that's really what I'm here to discuss.
He moved his chair closer.
All these equipment troubles we've been having. Everything works just fine until it's installed on the island. Then inexplicable problems crop up. It's caused us delays and cost overruns, not to mention the loss of morale.
He picked up his pipe.
Have you thought about a possible cause?
Not really. I don't know much about computers. Carrie didn't understand it. He kept saying there was some kind of malevolent force at work.
Needleman made a faint sound of derision. Yes, even him. Funny that a computer expert should be so superstitious.
He turned, and even in the dark, Malin could feel his stare.
Well, I have been giving it a lot of thought, and I've come to a conclusion. And it's not some kind of curse.
What then?
The captain's face glowed briefly as he relit his pipe. Sabotage.
Sabotage?
Hatch said incredulously.
But who? And why?
I don't know. Yet. But it's obviously someone in our inner circle. Someone with complete access to the computer system and the equipment. That gives us Rankin, Magnuson, St. John, Bonterre. Perhaps even Wapner, hoisted on his own petard.
Hatch was secretly surprised that Needleman could talk so calculatingly about Wapner, with the programmer's broken body lying only 6 feet away.
What about Streeter? He asked. The captain shook his head. Streeter and I have been together since Vietnam. He was petty officer on my gunboat. I know you and he don't see eye to eye, and I know he's a bit of an odd duck, but there's no chance he could be the saboteur. None. Everything he has is invested in this venture. But it goes deeper than that. I once saved his life. When you've been at war, side by side in combat with a man, there can never be a lie between you.
Very well, Hatch replied. But I can't think of a reason why anyone would want to sabotage the dig.
I can think of several, said Needleman. Here's one. Industrial espionage. Thalassa isn't the only treasure-hunting company in the world, remember. If we fail or go bankrupt, it would open the door to someone else.
Not without my cooperation.
They don't know that. Needleman paused. And even if they did, minds can always be changed.
I don't know, Hatch said. It's hard for me to believe that.
His voice trailed off as he remembered running into Magnuson the day before, in the holding area where artifacts were catalogued. She had been examining the gold doubloon found by Bonterre. At the time, he'd been surprised. The engineer, normally so controlled and devoid of personality, had been staring intently at the coin, a look of raw, naked desire on her face. She'd put it down quickly when he entered, with a furtive, almost guilty movement. Remember, the captain was saying, there's a $2 billion fortune to be won here. Plenty of people in this world would shoot a liquor store clerk for $20. How many more would commit any crime, including murder, for $2 billion? The question hung in the air. Needleman stood up and paced restlessly in front of the window, drawing heavily on his pipe. Now that the pit's been drained, we can reduce our workforce by half. I've already sent the sea barge and the floating crane back to Portland. That should make the job of security easier. But let us be clear about one thing. A saboteur may well be at work. He or she may have tampered with the computers, in effect forcing Carrie to join our team this morning. But it was McCallan who murdered Carrie Wapner. He turned suddenly from the window. Just as he murdered your brother. The man has reached across 3 centuries to strike at us. By God, Mallon, we can't let him defeat us now. We will break his pit and take his gold. And the sword. Hatch sat in the dark, a host of conflicting feelings welling up in him. He had never quite looked at the pit in those terms. But it was true. McCallan had, in a way, murdered his innocent brother and the almost equally innocent computer programmer. The water pit was, at base, a cruel, cold-blooded engine of death.
"I don't know about any saboteur," he said, speaking slowly. "But I think you're right about McCallan. Look at what he said in his last journal entry. He's designed that pit to kill anyone who tries to plunder it.
That's all the more reason to take a breather, study the journal, rethink our approach. We've been moving too fast, way too fast.
Malin, that's exactly the wrong approach.
Needleman's voice was suddenly loud in the small office. Don't you realize that would play right into the saboteur's hands? We have to move ahead with all possible speed, map out the interior of the pit, get the support structures in place. Besides, every day we delay means more complications, more hindrances. It's only a matter of time before the press gets wind of this. And the lassie is already paying Lloyd's $300,000 a week in insurance. This accident is going to double our premiums. We're over budget, and our investors aren't happy.
Malin, we're so close. How can you suggest we slow down now?
Actually, said Hatch steadily, I was suggesting we knock off for the season and resume in the spring. There was a hiss as Needleman sucked in his breath.
My God, what are you saying? We'd have to take down the cofferdam, reflood the whole works, disassemble Orthanc and Island One. You can't be serious.
Look, said Hatch, all along, we've assumed that there was some key to the treasure chamber. Now we learn that there isn't. In fact, it's just the opposite. We've been here 3 weeks already. August is almost over. Every day we stay increases the chance of a storm bearing down on us.
Needleman made a dismissive gesture. We're not building with tinker toys here. We can ride out any storm that comes along, even a hurricane if it comes to that.
I'm not talking about hurricanes or sou'westers. Those kinds of storms give 3 or 4 days' warning, plenty of time to evacuate the island. I'm talking about a nor'easter. They can scoop down on this coast with less than 24 hours' notice. If that happened, we'd be lucky just to get the boats into port.
Needleman frowned. I know what a nor'easter is.
Then you'll know it can bring crosswinds and a steep-walled sea even more dangerous than the swell of a hurricane. I don't care how heavily it's been reinforced. Your cofferdam would be battered down like a child's toy.
Needleman's jaw was raised at a truculent angle. It was clear to Hatch that none of his arguments was making any headway.
Look, Hatch continued, in as reasonable a tone as he could muster. We've had a setback, but it isn't a showstopper. The appendix may be inflamed, but it hasn't burst. All I'm saying is that we take the time to really study the pit, examine McCallan's other structures, try to understand how his mind worked. Forging blindly ahead is simply too dangerous.
I tell you, we may have a saboteur among us, that we can't afford to slow down, and you talk to me of blindness?
Needleman said harshly.
This is exactly the kind of pusillanimous attitude McCallan counted on. Take your time. Don't do anything risky. Piss your money away until nothing's left.
No, Malin. Research is all very fine, but... The captain suddenly lowered his voice, but the determination in it was startling.
Now's the time to go for the man's jugular.
Hatch had never been called pusillanimous before, had never even heard the word used outside of books, and he didn't like it much. He could feel the old hot anger rising within him, but he mastered it with an effort.
Fly off the handle now, and you'll wreck everything, he thought. Maybe the captain's right. Maybe Wapner's death has me rattled. After all, we've come this far. And we're close now, very close.
In the tense silence, he could make out the faint whine of an outboard coming over the water.
That must be the coroner's launch, Needleman said.
He had turned back toward the window, and Hatch could no longer see his face.
I think I'll leave this business in your hands.
He stepped away and headed toward the door. Captain Needleman, Hatch asked.
The captain stopped and turned back, hand on the knob. Although Hatch could not make out his face in the dark, he could feel the extraordinary force of the captain's gaze, directed inquiringly toward him.
"That sub full of Nazi gold," Hatch went on. "What did you do? After your son died, I mean."
"We continued the operation, of course," Needleman answered crisply. "It's what he would have wanted." Then he was gone, the only mark of his visit, the faint smell of pipe smoke, lingering in the night air.
Chapter 31
Bud Rowell was not a particularly church-going man. He'd become even less of one in the years following Woody Clay's arrival. The minister had a severe, fire-and-brimstone manner rarely found in the Congregational Church. Frequently, the man would lace his sermons with calls for his parishioners to take up a spiritual life rather more exacting than Bud cared for. But in Stormhaven, the ability to gossip fluently was required of a shopkeeper, and as a professional gossip, Rowell hated to miss anything important. Word had gone round that Reverend Clay had prepared a special sermon, a sermon that would include a very interesting surprise. Rowell arrived 10 minutes before the service to find the little church already wall to wall with townspeople. He worked his way toward the back rows, searching for a seat behind a pillar from which he could escape unnoticed. Unsuccessful in this, he settled his bulk near the end of a pew, his joints complaining at the hardness of the wooden seat. He gazed slowly around the congregation, nodding at the various superette patrons who caught his eye. He saw Mayor Jasper Fitzgerald up near the front, glad-handing the head of the city council. Bill Banns, the editor of the paper, was a few rows back, his green visor as firmly on his head as if it had been planted there. And Claire Clay was in her usual position of second row center. She'd become the perfect minister's wife, right down to the sad smile and lonely eyes. There were also a couple of strangers scattered about that he assumed were Thalassa employees. This was unusual. Nobody from the excavation had shown up in church before. Maybe the bad business that had taken place out there shook them up a bit. Then his eyes fell on an unfamiliar object, sitting on a small table next to the pulpit and covered with a crisp linen sheet. This was decidedly odd. Ministers in Stormhaven didn't make a practice of using stage props any more than they made a practice of yelling or shaking their fists or thumping Bibles. The church was standing room only by the time Mrs. Fanning arranged herself primly on the pipe organ bench and struck up the opening chords to "A Mighty Fortress Is Our God." After the weekly notices and the prayers of the people, Clay strode forward, his black robe loose on his gaunt frame. He moved into position behind the pulpit and looked around at the congregation, a humorless, fiercely determined expression on his face. "Some people," he began, "might think that a minister's job is to comfort people, make them feel good. I am not here today to make anyone feel good. It is not my mission, or my calling, to blind with consoling platitudes or soothing half-truths. I'm a plain-speaking man, and what I'm going to say will make some people uncomfortable. Thou hast showed thy people hard things." He looked about again, then bowed his head and said a short prayer. After a moment of silence, he turned to his Bible and opened it to the text of his sermon. "And the fifth angel sounded," he began in a strong, vibrant voice, "and I saw a star fall from heaven unto the earth, and to him was given the key of the bottomless pit. And he opened the bottomless pit, and there arose a smoke out of the pit as the smoke of a great furnace. And they had a king over them, which is the angel of the bottomless pit, whose name in the Hebrew tongue is Abaddon. The beast that ascendeth out of the bottomless pit shall make war against them, and shall overcome them and kill them. And their dead bodies shall lie in the streets. But the rest of the men repented not of the works of their hands, that they should not worship idols of gold and silver.
Clay raised his head and slowly closed the book.
Revelation, chapter 9, he said, and let an uncomfortable silence grow.
Then he began more quietly.
A few weeks ago, a large company came here to begin yet another doomed effort to recover the Ragged Island treasure. You have all heard the dynamite, the engines running night and day, the sirens and the helicopters. You have seen the island lit up in the dark like an oil platform. Some of you are working for the company, have rented rooms to its employees, or benefited financially from the treasure hunt.
His eyes roved the room, stopping momentarily on Bud. The grocer shifted in his seat and glanced toward the door.
Those of you who are environmentally concerned might be wondering what effect all the pumping, the muddy water, the gas and oil, the explosions, and the unceasing activity is having on the ecology of the bay. And those fishermen and lobstermen among you might wonder if all this has anything to do with the lobster catch being off 20% recently, and the mackerel run down almost as much.
The minister paused. Bud knew that the catch had been steadily dropping over the last 2 decades, dig or no dig. But this did not stop the considerable number of fishermen in the room from shifting restlessly in their seats.
But my concern today is not simply with the noise, the pollution, the ruination of the catch, or the despoliation of the bay. These worldly matters are the proper domain of the mayor, if he would only take them up.
Clay let a pointed glance fall upon the mayor. Bud watched as Fitzgerald smiled uncomfortably, a hand flying up to smooth one of his magnificent mustaches.
My concern is the spiritual effect of this treasure hunt.
Clay stepped back from the pulpit.
The Bible is very clear on this matter. Love of gold is the root of all evil, and only the poor go to heaven. There's no ambiguity, no arguing over interpretation. That's a hard thing to hear, but there it is. And when a wealthy man wanted to follow Jesus, he said, "Give away all your riches first." But the man couldn't do it. Remember Lazarus, the beggar who died at the rich man's gates and went to the bosom of Abraham? The rich man who lived behind the gates went to hell and begged for a drop of water to cool his parched tongue. But he did not receive it.
Jesus couldn't have said it more clearly. It is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God. He paused to look around.
Maybe this always seemed like someone else's problem to you. After all, most people in this town are not rich by any standard. But this treasure hunt has changed everything. Have you, any of you, stopped to think what will happen to our town if they succeed? Let me give you an idea. Stormhaven will become the biggest tourist attraction since Disneyland. It will make Bar Harbor and Freeport look like ghost towns. If you think the fishing is bad now, wait until you see the hundreds of tourist boats that will ply these waters. The hotels and the summer cottages that will spring up along the shore. The traffic. Think about the countless venture capitalists and gold seekers who will come, digging here, digging there, on shore and off, plundering and littering until the land is destroyed and the fishing beds obliterated. Sure, some in this room will make money. But will your fate be any different than that of the rich man in the parable of Lazarus? And the poorest among you, those who make their living from the sea, will be out of luck. There will be only 2 choices. public assistance, or a one-way bus ticket to Boston. At this mention of the two most despised things in Stormhaven, welfare and Boston, there was an unhappy murmur. Suddenly Clay leaned back, gripping the pulpit. "They will unleash the beast whose name is Abaddon. Abaddon, king of the pit. Abaddon, which in Hebrew means the destroyer." He scanned the rose sternly. "Let me show you something." Stepping away from the pulpit, he reached for the linen-covered shape on the small table. Bud leaned forward as an expectant hush filled the room. Clay paused a moment, then plucked the sheet away. Beneath was a flat, black stone, perhaps 12 by 18 inches, its edges badly worn and chipped. It was propped against an old box of dark wood. Carved into the face of the stone were 3 faint lines of letters, crudely highlighted in yellow chalk. Clay stepped up to the pulpit and, in a loud, trembling voice, repeated the inscription. "First will ye lie. Cursed shall ye cry. Worst must ye die." It's no coincidence this stone was found when the pit was first discovered, and that its removal triggered the water pit's first death. The prophecy on this evil stone has held true ever since. All of you who would seek idols of gold and silver, whether it be directly by digging or indirectly by profiting from the diggers, should remember the progression it describes. First will ye lie. The greed for riches will pervert your nobler instincts. He drew himself up. "At the lobster festival, Malin Hatch himself told me the treasure was worth a couple of $1 million. Not an inconsiderable sum, even for a man from Boston. But I later learned the real estimate was closer to $2 billion. $2 billion. Why would Dr. Hatch deceive me like that? I can tell you only this. The idols of gold are a seductive force. First will ye lie." His voice dropped. "Then there's the next line. Cursed shall ye cry. The gold brings with it the curse of sorrow. If you doubt that, talk to the man who lost his legs. And what is the last line of the curse? Worst must ye die." His hollow eyes parsed the audience. "Today, many of you want to lift the stone, so to speak, to get the gold idol underneath. The same thing Simon Rutter wanted 200 years ago. Well, remember what happened to Rutter." He returned to the pulpit. "The other day, a man was killed in the pit. I spoke to that man not 1 week ago. He offered no excuses for his own lust for gold. In fact, he was brazen about it. 'I'm no Mother Teresa,' he told me. Now, that man has died. Died in the worst way. The very life crushed out of him by a great stone. Worst must ye die. Verily I tell you, he hath his reward." Clay paused to draw breath. Bud glanced across the congregation. The fishermen and lobstermen were murmuring among themselves. Claire was looking away from the minister, down at her hands. Clay began again. "What about all the others who have died, or been crippled, or bankrupted by this accursed horde? This treasure hunt is evil incarnate, and all who profit from it, directly or indirectly, must expect to be held accountable. You see, in the final reckoning, it will not matter whether or not treasure is found. The mere search is a sin, abhorrent to God. And the more Stormhaven follows that path of sin, the more penance we can expect to pay. Penance in ruined livelihood. Penance in ruined fishing. Penance in ruined lives. He cleared his throat.
Over the years, there's been a great deal of talk about a curse on Ragged Island and the Water Pit. Now, a lot of people will dismiss such talk. They'll tell you that only ignorant, uneducated folk believe that kind of superstition.
He pointed toward the stone. Tell that to Simon Rudder. Tell that to Ezekiel Harris. Tell that to John Hatch.
Clay's voice fell almost to a whisper. There have been some strange doings on the island. Doings they're not telling you about. Equipment is malfunctioning mysteriously. Unexplained events are throwing things off schedule. And just a few days ago, they uncovered a mass grave on the island. A grave hastily filled with the bones of pirates. 80, perhaps 100 people. There were no marks of violence. Nobody knows how they died. The beast that ascendeth out of the bottomless pit shall make war against them, and their dead bodies shall lie in the streets.
How did these men die? Clay suddenly thundered. It was the hand of God. Because do you know what else was found with the dead?
The room fell so silent that Bud could hear the brushing of a twig against a nearby window.
Gold,
Clay said in a harsh whisper.
Chapter 32
As site doctor for the Ragged Island venture, Hatch was required to handle the red tape relating to Wapner's death. So, bringing in a registered nurse from down coast to watch the medical hut, he locked up the big house on Ocean Lane and drove to Machiasport, where a formal inquest was held. The following morning, he left for Bangor. By the time he finished filling out the reams of archaic paperwork and returned home to Stormhaven, 3 working days had passed. Heading to the island that same afternoon, he soon felt more confident he'd made the right decision in not challenging Needleman's decision to press on. Though the captain had been driving the cruise hard over the last several days, the effort and the exhaustive new precautions the teams had been taking since Wapner's death seemed to have dispelled much of the gloom. Still, the pace was taking its toll. Hatch found himself attending to almost 6 minor injuries during the course of the afternoon. And in addition to the injuries, the nurse had referred 3 cases of illness among the crew to him. A fairly high count, considering that the total personnel on the island had now dropped to 1/2 the original number. One complained of apathy and nausea, while another had developed a bacterial infection Hatch had read about but never seen. Yet another had a simple, non-specific viral infection. Not serious, but the man was running a pretty good fever. At least Needleman can't accuse him of malingering, Hatch thought as he drew blood for later testing on the Cerberus. Early the next morning, he wandered up the trail to the mouth of the water pit. The pace was obviously frantic. Even Bonterre, emerging from the pit with a handheld laser for measuring distances, barely had time for more than a nod and a smile. But a remarkable amount of work had been accomplished. The ladder array was now fully braced from top to bottom, and a small lift had been attached to one side for quick transport into the depths. A technician told him that the soundings and measurements of the pit's interior were now almost complete. Needleman was nowhere to be found, but the technician said the captain had gone practically without sleep for the last 3 days, closeted in Orthanc, directing the gridding out of the pit. Hatch found himself speculating on what the captain would do next. It wasn't surprising, his throwing himself into his work in the wake of Wapner's death.
But now the obvious tasks were almost done. The ladder array was complete, and the pit would soon be fully mapped. Nothing remained except to descend the pit and dig, with extreme caution, for the gold. Hatch stood silently for a minute, thinking about the gold and what he would do with his share. $1 billion was a stupendous amount of money. Perhaps it was unnecessary to put the entire sum into the Johnny Hatch Foundation. It would be hard even to give away such a sum. Besides, it would be nice to have a new boat for his berth in Lynn. And he found himself recalling a beautiful, secluded house on Brattle Street, close to the hospital, that was for sale. He also shouldn't forget that someday he would have children. Was it right to deprive them of a generous inheritance? The more he thought about it, the more it made sense to keep back a few million, perhaps as much as 5 for personal use, maybe even 10 as a cushion. Nobody would object to that. He stared down into the pit a moment longer, wondering if his old friend Donnie Truitt was on one of the teams working somewhere in the dark spaces beneath his feet. Then he turned and headed back down the path. Entering Island 1, he found Magnuson in front of the computer, her fingers moving rapidly over a keyboard, mouth set in a disapproving line. The ice cream sandwich wrappers and discarded circuit boards were gone, and the crowded racks of computer equipment, along with their fat looping cables and multicolored ribbons, had been placed in severe order. All traces of Wapner had vanished. Looking around, Hatch had the illogical feeling that the rapid cleanup was, in some strange way, a slight against the programmer's memory. As usual, Magnuson continued her work, completely ignoring Hatch. He looked around another minute. "Excuse me," he barked at last, feeling unaccountably gratified at the slight jump she gave. "I wanted to pick up a plain text transcript of the journal," he explained, as Magnuson stopped typing and turned to look at him with her curiously empty face. "Of course," she said evenly. Then she sat, waiting expectantly. "Well?" "Where is it?" she replied. This made no sense. "Where is what?" Hatch asked. For a moment, Hatch was certain a look of triumph flitted over the engineer's face before the mask descended once again. "You mean you don't have the captain's permission?" His look of surprise was answer enough. "New rules," she went on. "Only one hard copy of the decrypted journal is to be kept in stores, not to be signed out without written authorization from the captain." Momentarily, Hatch found himself left without a response. "Dr. Magnuson," he said as calmly as possible, "that rule can't apply to me. The captain didn't mention any exceptions." Without a word, Hatch stepped over to the telephone. Accessing the island's phone network, he dialed the number for Orthanc and asked for the captain. "Malin," came the strong voice of Needleman. "I've been meaning to drop by to find out how everything went on the mainland." "Captain, I'm here in Island 1 with Dr. Magnuson. What's this about me needing authorization to access the McCallan Journal?" "It's just a security formality," came the reply. "A way to keep the plain text accounted for. You and I talked about the need for that. Don't take it personally." "I'm afraid I do take it personally. Malin, even I am signing out the journal text. It's to protect your interests as much as the lass's. Now, if you'd put Sandra on, I'll explain to her that you have permission." Hatch handed the phone to Magnuson, who listened for a long moment without comment or change of expression. Wordlessly, she hung up the phone, then reached into a drawer and filled out a small yellow-colored chit. "Hand this to the duty guard over in stores," she said. "You'll need to put your name, signature, date, and time in the book." Hatch placed the chit in his pocket, wondering at Needleman's choice of guardian. Wasn't Magnuson on the captain's short list of saboteur suspects? But in any case, in the cold light of day, the whole idea of a saboteur seemed very far-fetched. Everyone on the island was being extremely well paid. Some stood to gain millions. Would some saboteur jeopardize a sure fortune over a larger but very uncertain one? It made no sense. The door swung open again, and the tall, stooped form of St. John entered the command center.
"Good morning," he said with a nod.
Hatch nodded back, surprised at the change that had come over the historian since Wapner's death. The plump white cheeks and the cheerful, smug look had given way to slack skin and bags beneath reddened eyes. The requisite tweed jacket was unusually rumpled. St. John turned to Magnuson.
"Is it ready yet?"
"Just about," she said. "We're waiting for one more set of readings. Your friend Wapner made rather a mess of the system, and it's taken time to straighten everything out." A look of displeasure, even pain, crossed St. John's face. Magnuson nodded at the screen. "I'm correlating the mapping team's data with the latest satellite images." Hatch's eyes traveled to the large monitor in front of Magnuson. It was covered with an impossible tangle of interconnected lines in various lengths and colors. A message appeared along the bottom of the screen. "Restricted video feed commencing 1123 EDT on Telstar 704, transponder 8Z, KU band, downlink frequency 14,044 megahertz, receiving and integrating." The complex tangle on the screen refreshed itself. For a moment, St. John stared at the screen wordlessly.
"I'd like to work with it for a while," he said at last.
Magnuson nodded.
"Alone, if you don't mind."
Magnuson stood up. "The three-button mouse operates the three axes. Or you can..."
"I'm aware of how the program works."
Magnuson left, closing the door to Island One behind her without another word. St. John sighed and settled into the now vacant chair. Hatch turned to leave.
"I didn't mean for you to go," St. John said. "Just her. What a dreadful woman."
He shook his head.
"Have you seen this yet? It's remarkable, really."
"No," Hatch said. "What is it?"
"The water pit and all its workings. Or rather, what's been mapped so far?"
Hatch leaned closer. What looked like a nonsensical jumble of multicolored lines was, he realized, a three-dimensional wireframe outline of the pit, with depth gradations along one edge. St. John pressed a key and the whole complex began to move, the pit and its retinue of side shafts and tunnels rotating slowly in the ghostly blackness of the computer screen.
"My God,"
Hatch breathed.
"I had no idea it was so complex. The mapping teams have been downloading their measurements into the computer twice a day. My job is to examine the pit's architecture for any historical parallels. If I can find similarities to other constructions of the time, even other work of McCallum's, it may help us figure out what booby traps remain and how they can be defused. But I'm having a difficult time. It's hard not to get swept away by the complexity. And despite what I said a minute ago, I have only the faintest conception of how this contraption works. But I'd rather swing from a gibbet than ask that woman for help."
He struck a few keys.
"Let's see if we can clear away everything but the original works."
Most of the colored lines disappeared, leaving only red. Now the diagram made more sense to Hatch. He could clearly see the big central shaft plunging into the earth. At the 100-foot level, a tunnel led to a large room, the vault where Wapner was killed. Deeper, near the bottom of the pit, six smaller tunnels angled away like the fingers of a hand. Directly above, a large tunnel climbed sharply to the surface. There was another narrow tunnel angling away from the bottom, plus a small array of side workings. St. John pointed to the lower set.
"Those are the six flood tunnels?"
"Six?"
"Yes. The five we found,
plus one devilish tunnel that didn't expel any dye during the test. Magnuson said something about a clever hydrological backflow system. I didn't understand half of it, to be honest.
He frowned.
That tunnel right above, with the gentle slope, is the Boston shaft, which was built much later. It shouldn't be displayed as part of the original works.
A few more keystrokes, and the offending tunnel disappeared from the screen. St. John glanced quickly at Hatch, then looked back at the screen again.
Now, this tunnel, the one that angles toward the shore...
He swallowed.
It isn't part of the central pit, and it won't be fully explored for some time yet. At first I thought it was the original back door to the pit, but it seems to come to a waterproofed dead end about halfway to the shore. Perhaps it's somehow linked to the booby trap that your brother...
His voice trailed off awkwardly.
I understand, Hatch managed to say, his own voice sounding dry and unnaturally thin to his ears.
He took a deep breath. They're making every effort to explore it, correct?
Of course.
St. John stared at the computer screen.
You know, until 3 days ago I admired McCallan enormously. Now I feel very differently. His design was brilliant, and I can't blame him for wanting his revenge on the pirate who abducted him. But he knew perfectly well this pit could just as easily kill the innocent as the guilty.
He began rotating the structure again.
Of course, the historian in me would say McCallan had every reason to believe Occam would live long enough to come back and spring the trap himself. But the pit was designed to live on and on, guarding the treasure long after Occam died trying to get it out.
He punched another key, and the diagram lit up with a forest of green lines.
Here you can see all the bracing and cribbing in the main pit. 400,000 board feet of heart of oak, enough to build 2 frigates. The structure was engineered to last hundreds of years. Why do you suppose McCallan had to build his engine of death so strong? Now, if you rotate it this way...
He poked another button, then another and another.
Damn,
he muttered as the structure began to whirl quickly around the screen.
Hey, you're going to burn out the video RAM if you twirl that thing any faster.
Rankin, the geologist, stood in the doorway, his bear-like form blotting out the hazy morning light. His blonde beard was parted in a lopsided smile.
Step away from that before you break it, he joked, closing the door and coming toward the screen.
Taking St. John's seat, he tapped a couple of keys and the image obediently stopped spinning, standing still on the screen as if at attention.
Anything yet?
He asked the historian.
St. John shook his head. It's hard to see any obvious patterns. I can see parallels here and there to some of McCallan's hydraulic structures, but that's about it. Let's turn it around the Z-axis at 5 revolutions per minute. See if it inspires us.
Rankin hit a few keys and the structure on the screen began rotating again. He settled back in his chair, threw his arms behind his head, and glanced at Hatch.
It's pretty amazing, man. Seems your old architect may have had some help with his digging. In a manner of speaking.
What kind of help, exactly?
Rankin winked.
From Mother Nature. The latest tomographic readings show that much of the original pit was already in place when the pirates arrived. In natural form, I mean. A huge vertical crack in the bedrock. That might even have been the reason Occam chose this island.
I'm not sure I understand.
There's a huge amount of faulting and displacement in the metamorphic rock underlying the island.
Now I'm sure I don't understand, Hatch said.
I'm talking about an intersection of fault planes right under the island. Planes that got pulled apart somehow.
So there were underground cavities all along?
Rankin nodded.
Lots. Open cracks and fractures running every which way. Our friend McCallan merely widened and added as needed. But the question I'm still struggling with is, why are they here, under this island only? Normally you'd see that kind of displacement on a wider scale. But here it seems restricted to Ragged Island. Their talk was interrupted as Needleman stepped into the hut. He looked at each of them in turn, a smile flicking across his face, then vanishing again.
Well, Malin, did Sandra give you the permission, Chit?
She did, thanks, Hatch replied. Needleman turned toward Rankin.
Don't stop on my account.
I was just helping St. John here with the 3D model, Rankin said. Hatch looked from one to the other. The easygoing geologist suddenly seemed formal, on edge. Has something happened between these two? He wondered. Then he realized it was something in the way Needleman was looking at them. He, too, felt an almost irresistible urge to stammer out excuses, explanations for what they were doing.
I see, Needleman said. In that case, I have good news for you. The final set of measurements has been entered into the network.
Great, Rankin said, and tapped a few more keys. Got it. I'm integrating now. As Hatch watched the screen, he saw small line segments being added to the diagram with blinding speed. In a second or two, the download was complete. The image looked much the same, though even more densely woven than before. St. John, looking over the geologist's shoulder, sighed deeply. Rankin hit a few keys and the model began spinning slowly on its vertical axis once again.
Take out all but the very earliest structures, St. John said.
Rankin tapped a few keys and countless tiny lines disappeared from the image on the screen. Now Hatch could see just a depiction of the central pit itself.
So the water traps were added toward the end, Needleman said. Nothing we didn't already know.
See any design elements common to McCallan's other structures? Rankin asked.
Or anything that might be a trap?
St. John shook his head.
Remove everything but the wooden beams, please.
Some more tapping, and a strangely skeletal image appeared against the blackness of the screen. The historian sucked in his breath with a sudden hiss.
What is it? Needleman asked quickly.
There was a pause. Then St. John shook his head.
I don't know.
He pointed to two places on the screen where several lines intersected.
There's something familiar about those joints, but I'm not sure what.
They stood a moment, a silent semicircle, gazing at the screen.
Perhaps this is a pointless exercise, St. John went on. I mean, what kind of parallels can we really hope to find to McCallan's other structures? What buildings are 10 feet across and 140-plus feet tall?
The Leaning Tower of Pisa, Hatch suggested.
Just a minute,
St. John interrupted sharply. He peered more closely at the screen.
Look at the symmetrical lines on the left. There. And there. And look at those curved areas, one below the other. If I didn't know better, I'd say they were transverse arches.
He turned toward Needleman.
Did you know the pit narrowed at the halfway point?
The captain nodded. From 12 feet across to about 9 at the 70-foot level. The historian began to trace points of contact across the wireframe model with his finger.
Yes, he whispered. That would be the end of an upside-down column. And that would be the base of an interior buttress. And this arch, here, would concentrate mass distribution at one point. The opposite of a normal arch.
Would you mind telling us what you're talking about? Needleman said.
His voice was calm, but Hatch could see sharp interest kindling in his eyes. St. John took a step away from the monitor, his face full of wonder.
It makes perfect sense. Deep and narrow like that? And McCallan was a religious architect, after all.
His voice trailed off. What man? Needleman hissed.
St. John turned his large calf eyes to Rankin.
Rotate the y-axis 180 degrees.
Rankin obliged, and the diagram on the screen rotated into an upside-down position. Now the outline of the water pit stood upright, frozen on the screen, a glowing red skeleton of lines.
Suddenly, there was a sharp intake of breath from the captain.
My God, he breathed. It's a cathedral.
The historian nodded, a triumphant smile on his face.
McKellen designed what he knew best. The water pit is nothing but a spire. A bloody upside-down cathedral spire.
Chapter 33.
The attic was more or less as Hatch remembered it, cluttered to overflowing with the kind of flotsam and jetsam families collect over decades of accumulated life. The dormer windows let in a feeble stream of afternoon light, which was quickly drowned in the gloomy stacks of dark furniture, old wardrobes and bedsteads, hat racks and boxes, and stacks of chairs. As Hatch stepped off the last step onto the worn boards, the heat, dust, and smell of mothballs brought back a single memory with razor sharpness. Playing hide-and-seek under the eaves with his brother, rain drumming loudly on the roof. He took a deep breath, then moved forward cautiously, fearful of upsetting something or making a loud noise. Somehow, this storehouse of memories was now a holy place, and he almost felt like a trespasser, violating its sanctuary. With the surveying of the original pit now completed by the mapping teams, and an insurance adjuster due on the island in the afternoon, Needleman had little choice but to call a half-day halt to activity. Mallon took the opportunity to head home for a bite of lunch, and perhaps a bit of research. He remembered a large picture book, the great cathedrals of Europe that had once been his great-aunt's. With any luck, he'd find it among the boxes of books that his mother had carefully stowed away in the attic. He wanted a private chance to understand a little better exactly what this discovery of St. John's meant. He made his way through the clutter, barking one shin on a scuffed bumper pool table and almost upsetting a hoary old Victrola, precariously balanced on a box full of 78s. He carefully replaced the Victrola, then glanced at the old records, scratched and worn to mere whispers of their original tunes. Puttin' on the Ritz, the Varsity Drag, Let's Misbehave, Bing Crosby and the Andrews Sisters riffing to Is You Is or Is You Ain't My Baby. He remembered how his father insisted on playing the ancient thing on summer evenings, the raucous old show tunes and dance numbers floating incongruously over the yard and down toward the pebbled shore. In the dim light of the attic, he could make out the great carved maple headboard of the family bed, leaning against a far corner. It had been presented by his great-grandfather to his great-grandmother on their wedding day. Interesting present, he thought to himself. Sure enough, beside the headboard was an ancient wardrobe, and behind the wardrobe he could make out the boxes of books, as neatly stacked as when he and Johnny had put them there, under orders from his mother. Hatch stepped up to the wardrobe and tried to force it aside. It moved an inch, perhaps a little more. He stepped back, contemplating the hideous, solid, top-heavy piece of Victoriana, an artifact from his grandfather's day. He heaved at it with his shoulders, and it moved a few inches, wobbling unsteadily. Considering how much the wood must have dried over the years, it was still damned heavy. Maybe some stuff remained inside. He sighed and wiped his brow. The wardrobe's upper doors were unlocked, and they swung open to reveal a musty, vacant interior. Hatch tried the drawers at the bottom and found them empty as well. All except for the bottom drawer. Stuffed in the back, torn and faded, was an old T-shirt with an iron-on Led Zeppelin logo. Claire had bought this for him, he remembered, on a high school outing to Bar Harbor. He turned the shirt over in his hands for a moment,
remembering the day she'd given it to him. Now it was just a 2-decade-old rag. He put it aside. She'd found her happiness now. Or lost it, depending on whom you asked. One more try. He grabbed the wardrobe and wrestled with it, rocking it back and forth. Suddenly it shifted under his grasp, tilting forward dangerously, and he leaped out of the way as the thing went plummeting to the floor with a terrific crash. He scrambled to his feet as an enormous cloud of dust billowed up. Then he bent down curiously, waving away the dust with an impatient hand. The wooden backing of the wardrobe had broken apart in 2 places, revealing a narrow recess. Inside, he could make out the faint lines of newspaper clippings and pages covered with loopy, narrow handwriting, their edges thin and brittle against the old mahogany.
Chapter 34.
The long point of ochre-colored land called Burnt Head lay south of town, jutting out into the sea like a giant's gnarled finger. On the far side of this promontory, the cliff tumbled, wooded and wild, down to the bay known as Squeaker's Cove. Countless millions of mussel shells, rubbing against each other in the brittle surf, had given the deserted spot its name. The wooded paths and hollows that lay in the shadow of the lighthouse had become known as Squeaker's Glen. The name had a double meaning for students at Stormhaven High School. The glen also functioned as the local Lover's Lane, and virginity had been lost there on more than one occasion. 20-odd years before, Malin Hatch had himself been one of those fumbling virgins. Now he found himself strolling the wooded paths again, uncertain what impulse had brought him to this spot. He had recognized the handwriting on the sheets hidden in the wardrobe as his grandfather's. Unable to bring himself to read them right away, he'd left the house intent on strolling down along the waterfront. But his feet had taken him back of the town, skirting the meadows around Fort Blacklock, and angling at last toward the lighthouse and Squeaker's Cove. He veered off onto a rutted path, a thin pencil line of black dropping through the thick growth. After several yards, the path opened into a small glade. On 3 sides, the rocky escarpment of Burnt Head rose steeply, covered in moss and creepers. On the 4th side, dense foliage blocked any view of the water, though the strange whispering of the mussel shells in the surf betrayed the nearness of the coast. Dim bars of light striped diagonally through the tree cover, highlighting ragged patches of grass. Despite himself, Hatch smiled as Emily Dickinson came unbidden to mind. "There's a certain slant of light," he murmured. "Winter afternoons, which oppresses like the heft of cathedral tunes." He looked around the secluded glade as the memories came charging back. Of one May afternoon in particular, full of nervous, roving hands and short, tentative gasps. The newness of it, the exotic sense of venturing into adult territory, had been intoxicating. He shook the memory away, surprised at how the thought of something that had happened so long ago could still be so arousing. That had been 6 months before his mother packed them off to Boston. Claire, more than anyone, had accepted his moods, accepted all the baggage that had come with being Malin Hatch, the boy who'd lost the better part of his family. "I can't believe the place is still here," he thought to himself. His eyes caught a crumpled beer can peeping from beneath a rock. Still here, and still apparently used for the same purposes. He sat down on the fragrant grass. A beautiful late summer afternoon, and he had the glen all to himself. No, not quite to himself. Hatch became aware of a rustling on the path behind him. He turned suddenly, and to his surprise, saw Claire step out into the glade. She stopped dead as she saw him, then flushed deeply. She was wearing a summery, low-cut print dress, and her long golden hair was gathered in a French braid that reached down her freckled back. She hesitated a moment,
then stepped forward resolutely.
"Hello again," Hatch said, jumping to his feet. "Nice day to bump into you."
He tried to make his tone light and easy. He wondered if he should shake her hand or kiss her cheek, and in the period of hesitation realized the time for doing either had already passed. She smiled briefly and nodded.
"How was your dinner?" he asked.
The question sounded inane even as it left his lips.
"Fine."
There was an awkward pause.
"I'm sorry," she said. "I must be intruding on your privacy."
She turned to go.
"Wait," he cried, louder than he'd intended. "I mean, you don't have to go. I was just out wandering. Besides, I'd like to catch up."
Claire looked around a little nervously.
"You know how small towns are. If anyone were to find us here, they'd think..."
"Nobody's going to find us," he said. "This is Squeaker's Glen, remember?" He sat down again and patted the ground next to him. She came forward and smoothed her dress with the self-conscious gesture he remembered.
"Funny we should meet here, of all places," he said.
She nodded.
"I remember the time you put oak leaves over your ears and stood on that stone over there, quoting the whole of Lycidas."
Hatch was tempted to mention a few other things he remembered. "And now that I'm an old bone cutter, I throw medical metaphors in with the obscure poetry."
"What's it been? 25 years? She asked.
"Just about." He paused for an awkward moment.
"So what have you been doing all this time?"
"You know, graduated from high school, planned to go to Orno and attend UMaine, but met Woody instead. Got married. No kids."
She shrugged and took a seat on a nearby rock, hugging her knees.
"That's about it."
"No kids?" Hatch asked. Even in high school, Claire had talked of her desire for children.
"No,"
she said matter-of-factly.
"Low sperm count."
There was a silence. And then Hatch, to his own horror, and for some reason he couldn't begin to understand, felt an irresistible wave of mirth sweep over him at the incongruous turn the stumbling conversation had taken. He snorted involuntarily, then burst out laughing, and continued laughing until his chest hurt and tears started. Dimly, he realized that Claire was laughing as hard as he was.
"Oh, Lord," she said, wiping her eyes at last. "What a relief it is to just laugh. Especially over this. Melon, you can't imagine what a terribly forbidden subject this is at home."
"Low sperm count." And they broke once again into choking peals of laughter. As the laughter fell away, it seemed as if the years and the awkwardness fell with it. Hatch regaled her with stories of medical school, gruesome pranks they played in human anatomy class, and his adventures in Suriname and Sierra Leone, while she told him the various fates of their common friends. Almost all of them had moved to Bangor, Portland, or Manchester. At last, she fell silent.
"I have a confession, Alan," she said. "This meeting wasn't a complete accident."
Hatch nodded.
"You see, I saw you walking past Fort Blacklock and... well, I took a wild guess where you were headed."
"Not so wild, it turns out."
She looked at him. "I wanted to apologize. I mean, I don't share Woody's feelings about what you're doing here. I know you're not in it for the money, and I wanted you to hear that from me. I hope you succeed."
"No need to apologize."
He paused.
"Tell me how you ended up marrying him."
She sighed and averted her eyes. "Must I?"
"You must."
"Oh, Malin, I was so... I don't know. You left, and you never wrote."
"No, no," she went on quickly. "I'm not blaming you. I know I stopped going out with you before then.
That's right. For Richard Moe, star quarterback. How is old Dick?
I don't know. I broke up with him 3 weeks after you left Stormhaven. I never cared for him much anyway. I was mad at you more than anything else. There was this part of you I could never reach. This hard place you kept from me. You had left Stormhaven long before you really left, if you know what I mean. It got to me after a while.
She shrugged.
I kept hoping you'd come after me. But then one day, you and your mother were gone.
Yep. Off to Boston.
I guess I was a pretty gloomy kid. After you left, it was all the same old guys in Stormhaven. God, they were so boring. I was all set to go to college. And then this young minister came. He'd been to Woodstock, been tear-gassed at the 68 Chicago Convention. He seemed so fiery and sincere. He'd inherited millions, you know, margarine, and he gave it all to the poor, every penny. Ellen, I wish you'd known him then. He was so different, full of passion for the big causes, a man who really believed he could change the world. He was so intense. I couldn't believe that he could have any interest in me. And you know, he never talked God to me. He just tried to live by his example. I still remember how he couldn't bear the thought of being the reason I didn't get my degree. He insisted I go to the community college. He's the only man I've ever met who would never tell a lie, no matter how much the truth might hurt.
So what happened?
Claire sighed and dropped her chin onto her knees. I'm not sure, exactly. Over the years, he seemed to shrink somehow. Small towns can be deadly, Mallon, especially for someone like Woody. You know how it is. Stormhaven is its own little world. Nobody cared about politics here. Nobody cared about nuclear proliferation, about starving children in Biafra. I begged Woody to leave, but he's so stubborn. He'd come here to change this little town, and he wasn't going to leave until he did. Oh, people tolerated him, and looked on all his causes and fundraisers with a kind of amusement. Nobody even got mad about his liberal politics. They just ignored it. That was the worst for him, being politely ignored. He became more and more... She paused, thinking. I don't know how to say it exactly. Rigid and moralistic. Even at home. He never learned to lighten up. And having no sense of humor made it harder.
Well, Maine humor can take some getting used to, Hatch said as charitably as he could.
No, Mallon, I mean it literally. Woody never laughs. He never finds anything funny. He just doesn't get it. I don't know if it's something in his background, or his genes, or what. We don't talk about it. Maybe that's one reason he's so ardent, so unmoving in the things he believes in. She hesitated. And now he has something to believe in, all right. With this crusade against your treasure hunt, it's like he has a new cause. Something he thinks Stormhaven will care about.
What is it about the dig, anyway? Hatch asked. Or is it the dig? Does he know about us?
She turned to look at him. Of course he knows about us. A long time ago he demanded honesty, so I told him everything. Wasn't all that much to tell.
She gave a short laugh.
Serves me right for asking, Hatch thought. Well, he'd better start looking for another cause. We're almost done. Really? How can you be sure?
The crew historian made a discovery this morning. He learned that McCallan, the guy who built the water pit, designed it as a kind of cathedral spire. Claire frowned.
A spire? There's no spire on the island.
No, no. I mean an upside-down spire. It sounded crazy to me, too. But when you think about it, it makes a lot of sense. He was explaining it to me. It felt good to talk, and Hatch somehow knew that he could trust Claire to keep a confidence. See, Red Ned Ockham wanted this McCallan to build something that would keep his treasure safe until he came back to retrieve it.
Retrieve it how?